I want you to do me a favor. Just for the next few minutes, I want you to completely forget everything you think you know about, like, the magic of Hollywood.
Right, the red carpets, the big orchestras, all of it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the soaring soundtracks, the emotional movie endings that make you cry in a crowded theater. Just forget all of it.
It's hard to do, but yeah.
Instead, I want you to look really closely at the underlying machinery. So think of our usual view of entertainment, like standing on the main floor of this massive, opulent casino.
You're just seeing the flashing neon lights.
Right, you're hearing the jackpot bells ringing, you're totally mesmerized by the show happening on stage. But today, this deep dive is taking you straight down into the basement vault.
The fun stuff.
Oh, for sure. We are going to see who actually holds the cash, you know, who owns the building itself, and how the entire game is mathematically rigged in their favor.
Because leaving the theater and entering the boardroom kind of changes the entire perspective.
It really does. And the document guiding us through that vault today is this brand new, just incredibly dense report from June 2026. It's called the U.S. Entertainment Industry Structural Report.
And it is a massive piece of research. I mean, it covers the entire modern landscape, streaming platforms, global sports rights, the video game industry, and obviously the new labor contracts built around artificial intelligence.
Yeah, it covers literally everything. And the central thesis we're exploring today is pretty provocative.
Definitely.
The report argues that entertainment is basically no longer a storytelling industry. It has evolved into a ruthless power industry.
Yeah, which is a big shift. So if we are moving away from, you know, the movie itself being the golden ticket, what actually replaces it? Because we grew up in a world where the hit song or the blockbuster movie was the ultimate prize.
Right. If you made the best art, you won.
Exactly. But the report makes a very sharp distinction between those old scarce assets and the new ones. It
Yeah.
argues that the entertainment industry, it really shouldn't be understood as this loose, glamorous collection of film studios and music labels and celebrities anymore.
It's something much colder.
Right. It is a highly optimized system of power. So the scarce assets today are things like controllable intellectual property, direct customer access, massive data feedback loops, and production capacity.
Now, the industry center of gravity just shifted completely away from the physical distribution models we used to know.
Totally.
I mean, that old model feels so quaint now. You had a theatrical window where a movie played exclusively in cinemas for months.
Right? And then it trickled down to premium cable.
Yeah, and eventually you bought the DVD. Or, you know, you paid for a massive cable bundle full of channels, participating in what the report calls linear
The
television.
old scheduled broadcasting.
Exactly. Where a network dictated what time a show aired, and you literally just had to be sitting on your couch at 8 p.m. to watch it.
Yeah, and that old linear model, it relied on fixed windows and physical scarcity. But the new model is built on direct-to-consumer platforms,
Right.
algorithmic discovery, and, you know, fan communities that can be monetized in a dozen different ways simultaneously. So the conclusion here is that the winners in entertainment aren't necessarily the best storytellers anymore.
Wow.
Yeah, the winners are the entities that can combine IP, technology, capital, and labor rules to basically turn your attention into repeatable cash flow.
Okay, I have to push back on this premise just a little bit.
Go for it.
Because surely at the end of the day, a genuinely amazing story, or like a hit song that perfectly captures the cultural zeitgeist, will break through any corporate system,
Let's
right?
hope so.
Right.
Okay.
Like, doesn't the content itself still hold the ultimate power? I mean, if I write the best script in the world will beat a path to my door.
It's a very comforting, very romantic thought. But the report draws a hard line between content companies and platform companies.
Okay, what's the difference?
Well, a brilliant story still requires distribution to actually reach an audience. So content companies own the brands and the creative relationships. But platform companies, they own the customer interface,
Oh, so
right?
it's
They control the recommendation algorithm that decides whether that brilliant movie even shows up on your home screen in the first place. They own the credit card relationship.
So they hold all the cards.
Literally. If a tech platform owns the pipe that reaches into your living room and, you know, holds the data on your viewing habits, they can prioritize their own in-house content and they can demand vastly better financial terms from the creators.
Okay, so the person who owns the highway is basically always going to be more powerful than the person driving the fancy sports car.
Exactly. The platform can just close the toll booth or raise the price of the ticket.
Man, that is bleak.
Yeah. And the largest conflicts we see in Hollywood today, they occur precisely when a content owner realizes they need a platform's distribution way more than the platform needs any single piece of that content.
Wow. Okay, so if the platform and the IP dictate the power dynamics, we need to look at the massive corporations hoarding these assets, right? The titans of this new era.
Right, the big players.
Yeah, the report breaks down the major players using their 2025 and 2026 data. And it is just fascinating to see how differently they approach this dominance.
It really is.
Take Disney, for example. In their 2025 fiscal year, they brought in nearly $95 billion. And the report labels them the ultimate IP and experiences flywheel.
And that flywheel concept, it's crucial to understanding Disney's specific machinery.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't just make a movie to sell tickets.
Right.
The movie is just the top of a massive funnel.
Okay, let's trace how that actually works. So say they invent a brand new superhero character in a big summer blockbuster.
Sure.
That movie makes money at the box office, sure. But then that character immediately gets a spin-off series on the Disney Plus streaming service, which, you know, keeps you paying your monthly subscription.
Right. And then what happens?
Then that same character gets a dedicated ride at the theme parks, which drives vacation bookings. Then they sell the plastic action figures, the lunch boxes, the video game skins.
The merch is endless.
It really is. The initial story is just like the spark to ignite this massive self-contained ecosystem where every single division subsidizes and advertises the other divisions.
Exactly. And now you contrast that highly contained ecosystem with Netflix.
Okay.
So Netflix reported over $45 billion in streaming revenue for 2025. But their machinery operates on a completely different logic.
Because they don't have the lunchboxes.
Right. They don't have nearly a century of legacy IP. They aren't building theme parks. Netflix basically turned their immense scale, their international production footprint, and that recommendation data into a global utility.
A global utility. I like that.
Yeah. Their power source is just the sheer volume of their subscriber relationship and obviously the resulting pricing power.
So they don't care about building the theme park. They just want to own the global power grid. They want to dictate what lights up on your screen every single night, no matter where you live.
And then you have a player like YouTube.
Oh, man, YouTube.
Alphabet disclosed that YouTube surpassed $60 billion in revenue in 2025 across ads and premium subscriptions.
That is just wild to think about its evolution. I mean, it's no longer just a chaotic repository for viral clips.
Not at all.
It is the dominant infrastructure for the entire creator economy, competing directly with television, streaming services, and music platforms all at the same time.
Yeah, and while those tech-forward giants consolidate their power, the report also highlights this massive structural unbundling happening with the legacy media companies.
Right.
Like, we're seeing companies like Warner Bros.,
mm-hmm.
Discovery, separating their streaming and studio assets from their traditional global TV networks.
And we saw Comcast's 2026 plan to spin off NBC Universal and Sky Networks from their core broadband business, right?
Exactly.
So why are Wall Street and the capital markets forcing these companies to just tear themselves apart like that?
Well, it basically comes down to financial mechanics and valuation. Investors look at a massive media conglomerate and they see this blended, kind of confusing business.
Right.
So on one side, you have streaming platforms and studios, which are viewed as long-term growth assets. But on the other side, you have legacy linear cable networks, which are viewed as declining assets.
Because people are cutting the cord.
Exactly. They are slowly losing subscribers and advertising dollars every single year. And Wall Street hates when a declining business drags down the valuation of a growing business.
Oh, that makes sense.
So by spinning off the cable networks, these companies create a pure play growth stock for investors while kind of isolating all the debt and the decline in a completely separate entity.
That makes perfect sense. It's really about separating the engine from the heavy anchor.
Exactly.
And this ties directly into a concept the report calls choke points. Power in this new era concentrates at specific nodes or bottlenecks in the value chain.
Yeah, and controlling a choke point means you control access. It could be monopolizing a specific type of IP or controlling the primary distribution interface or just having unlimited capital to outspend your rivals.
Okay.
Look at Sony's strategy. They're entirely unique among the major studios because they never even tried to launch a massive general entertainment streaming service in the U.S. to compete with Disney Plus or Netflix.
Yeah, they just decided not to participate in the streaming war directly.
Right.
They are the company pouring the concrete and selling the asphalt. Like, they don't care which streaming delivery trucks drive on the road or who wins the delivery war, as long as literally everyone has to buy the asphalt from them.
That is a perfect way to frame it. Sony acts as a flexible, high-end supplier. They control a massive choke point in gaming through the PlayStation ecosystem.
Right.
But on the film and television side, they produce premium content and just license it to the highest bidder, whether that's Amazon, Netflix, or Apple.
Because they aren't forced to keep all their best shows exclusively for their own platform. Which brings us to how these companies are actually extracting money from our attention. The days of a studio making a movie, selling you a single $12 ticket, and calling it a successful business model are completely over.
Long gone.
Yeah, the report refers to this modern financial architecture as the right stack.
And that single sale transaction, it's really been replaced by a portfolio strategy. One piece of intellectual property has to generate multiple overlapping cash flows across completely different windows and territories.
It's like they aren't just selling you a glass of milk anymore.
No, they're selling the milk, the cheese, the leather, and then charging you $30 for a guided tour of the barn. That is exactly what it is. And we're seeing this strategy drastically alter the streaming landscape, too.
Oh, yeah.
Because for the better part of a decade, the narrative was just growth at all costs.
Right.
Streamers burned billions of dollars on content just to acquire new subscribers. But the report details how that era has just abruptly ended. We've officially entered the profitability war.
And we've all felt the consequences of that war as consumers, honestly.
Oh, for sure.
But what are the actual mechanics behind it? Like, why are we suddenly seeing ads everywhere and getting kicked off our families' accounts?
Well, once a platform reaches market saturation, meaning almost everyone who wants an account basically already has one, the only way to appease Wall Street is to squeeze more revenue out of the existing user base.
Squeeze the sponge.
Right. So the focus shifts entirely to average revenue per user, or ARPU, and margin expansion.
Got it.
So they implement password sharing crackdowns to force free riders to pay. They introduce advertising tiers, which, believe it or not, often actually generate more revenue per user than the ad-free tiers.
Wait, really? The ad tiers make more.
Yeah, because they combine this subscription fee with highly targeted, really lucrative digital ad rates. They are essentially rebuilding the traditional television advertising model, but inside a digital framework where literally everything is perfectly measurable.
That is wild. But the machinery doesn't stop at the edge of our screens, does it?
No, it doesn't.
Because the report dives heavily into interactive fandom and physical live events, and the numbers here are just astronomical.
They really are.
U.S. consumer spending on video games hit over $60 billion in 2025. Video games are just dwarfing legacy entertainment categories.
Yeah, and games are no longer standalone software products that you play for 40 hours and just, put back on the shelf.
Right.
They operate as continuous interactive fandom systems. They are primary social platforms where younger generations hang out, they attend virtual concerts, and they express their identities through, digital purchases.
And as digital content becomes infinite and essentially free to reproduce, physical live scarcity becomes the ultimate premium product.
Exactly.
Like Live Nation reported 159 million fans attending 55,000 events in 2025. People are just desperate to be in a room with other people.
Yeah, which perfectly explains the absolute frenzy over live sports rights right now.
Right. The report highlights the NBA's new 11-year media deals with Disney, NBCUniversal, and Amazon that kicked off in the 2025 season. And we also see the NFL locking up its television rights through 2033.
It's insane.
The billions of dollars changing hands here are just hard to comprehend. Are live sports literally the only thing keeping traditional television broadcasting alive at this point?
Honestly, they are the foundation holding the entire legacy structure up. Sports are the final massive DVR-proof asset.
DVR proof, I like that.
Yeah, it's appointment viewing.
Yeah.
You can't watch a championship game on a 24-hour delay. The cultural conversation will have completely moved on without you.
That's so true.
So because it guarantees a massive simultaneous live audience, platforms and networks are willing to pay almost any price. It drives immediate subscriptions and commands the highest premium advertising rates in the world.
Wow. Okay, so where do traditional movie theaters fit into this right stack then? Have they just been relegated to pure nostalgia?
Not nostalgia, no. Theaters have evolved into a premium marketing launchpad.
Oh, interesting.
They are now event businesses. A global theatrical run creates cultural urgency, right? It builds franchise momentum for massive IP, generating word of mouth that pays huge dividends when that movie eventually hits the streaming platform.
So the goal isn't just box office profit anymore. It's about creating an inescapable cultural footprint.
Exactly.
Okay, so we have these massive platforms and we have billions of dollars flowing through this highly optimized rights stack. But, you know, every single piece of this machinery relies on human beings actually creating the IP. The writers, the actors, the directors, the lighting technicians, which leads us to a massive ongoing conflict over labor.
The huge conflict.
Yeah. And this brings us to what I think is honestly the most profound practical rule in the entire report. And I'm going to quote it here. In entertainment, power belongs to whoever can say no without losing access to the market.
I love that quote. It perfectly defines the metric of leverage. A superstar actor can say no to a bad deal because they know the global audience will just follow them to another studio. A sports league can say no because live premium games are a completely irreplaceable asset.
Right.
A tech platform can say no because they control the interface to hundreds of millions of users. And crucially, a labor union can say no when a coordinated work stoppage can completely paralyze the entire production pipeline.
Yeah, and that context just completely reframes the massive 2023 WGA and SAG-AFTRA strikes.
It really does.
Because at the time, if you were just reading the headlines, it felt like a standard labor dispute over, you know, streaming pay and residuals.
Sure.
But looking back from this 2026 perspective, the report clarifies that the fight over streaming data and those protections against artificial intelligence, they were existential battles over the entire future of creative economics.
Absolutely. The guilds recognized immediately that generative AI wasn't just a new tool, right? It wasn't like a better digital camera or a faster editing software.
Yeah, right.
It was a potential mechanism to completely bypass human leverage.
Because if a studio doesn't need a human writer or actor, the human loses the power to say no.
Exactly. That is why the contractual guardrails established during those strikes, mandating human consent, controlling the use of digital replicas, restricting synthetic performances, they were so critical. They established the legal minimums for the future of production.
Okay, wait. I want to explore that AI vulnerability from the studio's perspective for a second.
Sure.
Because if unions get their power by halting production, wouldn't a generative AI workforce be a studio executive's ultimate dream?
You would think so.
Right. Like, a synthetic workforce never sleeps, it never complains about working conditions, it never demands residual checks, and most importantly, it never goes on strike.
Right.
So why wouldn't a studio just fire literally everyone and prompt their way to a blockbuster?
Well, it is the defining paradox of the current technological moment. AI can absolutely lower the cost of certain production workflows. Things like localization, global dubbing, or, you know, background visual effects. But trying to replace the core creative generation introduces this catastrophic legal risk regarding the chain of title.
Oh, okay, let's define that. Chain of title is basically the documented legal history of who owns a piece of intellectual property from the moment it is created to the present day, correct?
Correct. Yeah, the entire valuation of a major studio depends on holding an ironclad monopoly over its IP.
Right.
They need to exploit that copyright for decades across that massive flywheel we discussed earlier.
Right, the lunchboxes and theme park.
Exactly. Yeah. But the legal framework surrounding AI training data and the copyrightability of synthetic outputs is incredibly unstable right now.
Oh, I see the mechanism here.
Yep.
If a studio decides to cut costs and just uses an AI program to write the script for their next huge superhero movie, the current legal precedent suggests they cannot actually copyright that AI-generated script.
Right.
Which means any rival studio or literally a random person on the internet could legally take that exact script, film their own version of it, and sell the merchandise, completely destroying the original studio's monopoly.
You've hit the exact vulnerability. You cannot build a billion-dollar franchise on a foundation that you don't legally own.
Wow.
So the unions, working alongside elite gatekeepers like the major talent agencies and the entertainment lawyers, they have essentially determined the floor for what is allowed.
So the studios cannot replace the human element entirely because the legal and union frameworks dictate what can actually be copyrighted, protected, and ultimately monetized safely.
Exactly.
So the entertainment lawyers and the labor unions are essentially acting as the industry's immune system.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah, they are keeping the human element from being completely optimized out of the equation because the legal risks of a purely synthetic production are just simply too high for Wall Street to stomach.
Yeah, and it highlights why representation, the agents, the managers, the legal teams, it's not merely a service business in Hollywood.
Right.
It is an infrastructure layer. Elite agencies know exactly where raw talent, capital, and distribution intersect. And their job is to basically convert raw leverage into enforceable protective contracts.
Fascinating. So what does this all mean for you, the person listening right now?
The big question.
Right, because we've mapped out this massive battlefield. We've seen the platform titans, the mechanics of the rights stack, the unbundling of traditional TV, and these intense labor fights over AI copyright.
It's a lot to take in.
It really is. So how do new players, individual creators, or even outside investors navigate this matrix without getting completely crushed?
Well, the report lays out a specific strategic playbook, and it is incredibly insightful.
Okay, hear it.
The first piece of advice is directed at entrepreneurs and startups. And the report is just very blunt. Do not try to build a mini Netflix or a boutique streaming service.
Or don't even try.
No, you will lose. The incumbents have an absolutely insurmountable scale advantage.
Right.
Instead, you need to build the infrastructure for the new era. Build the picks and shovels.
Okay. The report highlights things like specialized workflow tools, right?
Mm.
Or advanced rights management software designed specifically to track IP licensing in the AI era.
Mm.
Or like podcast-to-video conversion pipelines, or tools that seamlessly handle local-to-global dubbing. You want to build the repeatable, essential systems that help creators and studios function rather than gambling on making a hit show yourself.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And for investors looking at the media landscape, the playbook focuses on separating durable rights from the hype cycle.
Okay, what does that look like?
So the most attractive investments are assets that generate recurring revenue and can be remonetized globally over time. Things like massive music catalogs or publishing royalties.
Oh, sure.
Provided they are purchased at disciplined prices, of course. Conversely, the report strongly warns against investing in heavily indebted legacy linear TV networks that lack live sports rights to anchor their viewership.
Because they don't have that DVR-proof asset.
Exactly.
Okay, so what about the creators? The YouTubers, the independent podcasters, the digital filmmakers who are building audiences right now.
Well, the golden rule for creators in this report is perhaps the most important takeaway of all. It's this. Use platforms as distribution, but do not let them be your entire business.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, creators must aggressively prioritize owning their audience data. They need direct email lists, independent membership models, long-form IP, and trademarkable brands.
I love this concept because it crystallizes the danger of the whole digital landscape. Like, if you rely entirely on an algorithm to reach your fans, you are essentially a tenant farmer on YouTube or TikTok's land.
Right. You don't own the soil.
Exactly. You don't own the soil. You might use their tools to grow a fantastic, profitable crop this season, but the digital landlord can change the algorithm, raise the rent, or just evict you and delete your channel at a moment's notice.
It happens all the time. So the strategic advantage for any modern creator is to leverage the massive free reach of these tech platforms for initial discovery, but then immediately move your deepest, most valuable fan relationships into channels that you actually own and control outright.
Yeah, bringing this all together. I mean, whether you're prepping for a boardroom strategy meeting, analyzing media stocks for your portfolio, or honestly, just trying to understand why your social media feed keeps surfacing the exact same types of videos, recognizing these hidden architectures is absolutely key.
It really is.
You're no longer just looking at a fun movie or a convenient app. You're seeing the underlying copyright mechanisms, the algorithmic incentives, and the massive battle for venue control.
You are finally seeing the Matrix.
Honestly, yeah.
Because content will always be the visible product that we enjoy.
Yeah.
But the true power in this industry is derived from that invisible architecture.
Right.
When you understand the choke points, you know, who controls the underlying intellectual property, who captures the consumer data, and who dictates the interface, you understand exactly why the entertainment industry operates the way it does.
It's all connected.
Yeah, the real battle isn't about which medium or genre is best. It's about who captures the financial surplus when your human attention is converted into corporate cash flow.
Okay, let's recap the journey we just took today. We started by realizing that Hollywood has transformed into this rigorous power industry where IP, data, platforms, and capital basically combine to harvest human attention.
A huge shift.
Yeah. We analyzed the platform Titan, so Disney's self-feeding ecosystem, versus Netflix's global utility grid. We explored the financial mechanics of Wall Street unbundling and how that single movie ticket evolved into a multi-layered rights stack designed to squeeze profitability from literally every angle.
Right.
Then we broke down the labor fights, discovering how the legal requirement for a chain of title protects human creators against AI. And finally, we walked through the survival playbook for anyone trying to build a business in this space, remembering never to be a tenant farmer on someone else's digital land. A
lot of ground covered.
We really did. But as we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder, something that steps a bit outside the boardroom. Because we've spent this entire deep dive analyzing the machinery, right? We've talked extensively about how these massive corporations optimize your fandom and your emotional identity into commerce.
Yeah, we have.
But as our digital behavior becomes perfectly measured, perfectly optimized, and just relentlessly monetized across every screen we own, what actually happens to us when the simple act of being a fan is fully financialized?
Oh, well, yeah.
Right. Like when your genuine love for a character or your deep connection to a song is quantified and traded like a commodity on the open market, does it fundamentally change the way we actually love the art?
That is a very heavy thought to carry.
It really is. Next time you find yourself captivated by the flashing lights of that casino floor, just remember, you now know exactly how the vault operates. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the media you consume, and we'll catch you next time.